Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I think America is basically like creating and exporting a mode of experiencing reality that is bad for us. It's like the evil Coca-Cola of the 21st century.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Argument. My name is Jerusalem Demsis.
I'm Matthew Iglesias.
And this week we have a great friend of the pod on, Derek Thompson. Thanks for coming on.
It is wonderful to be here. Thank you so much.
We're going to talk about loneliness today. And I don't know, maybe we should start with Derek. Why are you so obsessed with loneliness? What's going on? Are you okay?
I think I'm okay. I mean, you know, like all research is me-search. So I do think it's funny. I wrote this article when I was living in North Carolina when my wife was finishing up her PhD at UNC. And I met some wonderful people in North Carolina, some people who are still my friends. But I was disconnected from the vast majority of my friends who live in New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. And many of them live, as you and Matt do, in the non-summer months in Washington, D.C. And so to a certain extent, like, I was kind of lonely in North Carolina. And so it was not difficult for me to write a 6,000-8,000 word draft on the epidemic of aloneness in America. I do think that, like, there's a certain way in which, while I love writing and I love podcasting, these are somewhat inherently lonely jobs. Like, it is impossible to write with somebody else. Like, that's an absolute nightmare. Writing something with someone else is very, very difficult to do.
Have you ever co-authored a book?
Like,
Derek?
Co-authoring a book. Yeah, exactly. Fortunately, the nice thing about co-authoring a book is it can be done very asynchronously, right? Like, the Google Doc is there and you can jump into it when Ezra's out of it. But, like, seeing the EK icon in the upper right-hand corner while I was writing something, nightmare. So, co-writing is in a synchronous way is absolutely horrendous. Writing is inherently lonely. Reading is somewhat inherently lonely. Hard to read and also be social at the same time. So I do think that I am particularly, this is a longer answer than you probably bargained for. I think I am particularly sensitive to loneliness, which may have been an inspiration for this article.
But I also think that writers, you know, to generalize a little bit, but I think in part because of what you're talking about, like, this is a profession that tends to select for people who are relatively comfortable being alone. You know, that there's lots of jobs that are much more interpersonal, that are much more interactive. And if that's something that you really value in life, not to say I would never, you know, discourage anyone from a career in journalism, which is a thriving
field. I think
you
have done that.
growing at all times. But, you know, my father's a novelist. You know, this is a guy who my whole life, like, he would get up in the morning and, like, go to this, like, tiny little office where he worked alone and, like, bang away at his computer all day. And, you know, he's okay with that. Like, that's that's a life that he enjoys. I'm like a little less introverted than he is. And so I like to at least, like, have a newsroom and participate with people. But still, like, yeah, like, when it's time to work, to put words to the page, it's like you're alone. And I like that. And not everybody does.
I think you're already pulling on a major thread of my essay and a thread that I think a lot of people missed, which is that what you'll sometimes have is people who have a certain disposition for introversion go into professions like, say, writing, where they're often very alone. And, you know, the cliche of the writer and even the artist is not one of a worker or profession that's, like, overwhelmingly happy. Yeah. In fact, the profession is known for tortured artists and tortured writers, and even in some cases, writers who hate writing and have a very complicated relationship with the thing that they have, with full volition, chosen to do with their time. And one of the ideas that I try to get at in my essay is that in some cases, while I believe that introversion exists, and I believe that a spectrum between introversion and extroversion exists, like so many other spectra exists in across the human population, I think we over-demand a lot of alone time in the modern world. I think people overdemand alone time when they're on TikTok, when they're staying at home watching Netflix, even maybe when they become writers. You know, maybe the cliche of the writer who is also somewhat miserable is not so much a phenomenon of writing itself being misery, although, of course, all of us having written know that writing can be misery. It's also the fact that we've chosen a profession which sometimes disconnects us from the kind of social connection that often provides support when people in other jobs feel a certain kind of ennui in their work. And so I think this is like an important ball to keep in the air, which is that sometimes we demand a certain amount of aloneness that isn't particularly good for us, even if the name that we give to that kind of sickly feeling isn't loneliness.
So I'm a data respecter, and so I want us to get into the weeds here about like what you're actually finding about increased rates of aloneness, because I mean, again, like maybe this is just because I'm a writer, whatever. You know, you don't want to over lean on your own personal experiences. I agree that I am alone a lot, whether I'm writing or maybe when you're like commuting home, whatever it is. I do not feel bad about this. It feels like totally fine to me. And I think we'll get into this a little bit more. And I know you make this distinction between aloneness and loneliness, but like, let's just, what are the facts? Like, are people alone more? Where are they alone more? Why? What's going on?
Yeah. So I think you're already beginning to break this down into two really important questions. One is like, what's going on? And two is like, why is it bad? Right? Because maybe people are spending more time alone, and that's actually fantastic. Like, maybe we should spend way more time alone than we already are. So first off, you know, Robert Putnam published this book in the year 2000 called Bowling Alone. And it was about the fact that there was declining social capital and people were spending more time amongst themselves. And a lot of sociologists and academics like laughed at him. And they were like, this is crazy. Like in the 21st century, you're obviously going to see people snap back to socializing. So what have we seen? Well, the American Time Use Survey thankfully asks Americans how much time they spend socializing in person. And between 2003 and 2024, 2025, in-person socializing declined by about 20-25%. According to follow-up surveys that have been done by economists at the Federal Reserve, Americans spend more time alone than in any period for which we have good data. Some other numbers that I remember calculating, I spent like so much time in the American Time Use Survey databases, of course, entirely by myself. So Derek, alone, researching all the ways that aloneness can be bad for us. And just some of the facts I thought were incredible were, one, men who watch television now spend 7 hours in front of the TV for every 1 hour that they spend hanging out with somebody outside of their house. This one was really controversial. The typical female pet owner now spends more time actively engaged with her pet than she spends in face-to-face contact with friends of her own species. And since the early 2000s, the amount of time that Americans say they spend helping or caring for people outside their nuclear family has also declined by more than 30%. So in many cases, I think this is chosen solitude. I think this is people choosing to be alone. And there's many, many reasons for this. But maybe the most important reason is one that Matt has written about all the time, or certainly tweeted about all the time, which is just that like aloneness is way easier and better in many ways than it used to be. It's certainly more entertaining. It's just so easy to stay alone at home on your couch, watching Netflix, looking at TikTok. That is free, or at least no additional charge on a per hour basis. Entertainment. And indeed, Patrick Sharkey, a sociologist at Princeton, has found that the amount of time that we spend in our houses has increased significantly this century. So people are choosing over and over again to spend more time alone in their homes rather than socializing with other people.
And, you know, I think about, I'm you know, older than you and older than Jerusalem. And
certainly
so, I
mean, older
I,
than me.
I remember vividly being a young adult in a moment when the technology of home entertainment was quite different from how it is today. And so when I lived in a house with five roommates, which was not that long ago in the great, I guess there were five of us in the house. So me and four roommates, and we had mobile phones, but our phones did not have streaming video apps on them. Like I couldn't watch a movie on my phone. We had a television. One television that sat in the living room and it was connected to a cable box or to a TiVo that had a cable card in it. And so if you wanted to watch TV, there was this one room and you would typically find yourself watching TV with other people. And the downside of that is that it meant you weren't always watching the thing you wanted to watch. Like, I watched a lot of Felicity reruns because two of my roommates were into that. And my probably most pro-Felicity roommate also found herself watching a lot of Star Trek The Next Generation reruns. You know, and there's like a swingman who liked both of those shows. And it's like, would I say that Felicity is one of my favorite television shows of all time? No, I wouldn't choose to watch it in my alone time. I would never put it on. But are some of my good memories of life watching Felicity with other people? Like, yes, right? And that to me is like the yin and the yang of it. Like, it's just, it's unquestionably better to be able to watch the show that you want to watch rather than the show that your roommates want to watch. It's better to like be able to relax alone than to come back home from a stressful day of work and be like, I just kind of like have to stay on. But also, I like obtained value from those experiences of doing things I didn't necessarily want to do with other people that endure. Whereas I can't be like, oh, 6 years ago when I rewatched The Sopranos for the second time, I like really appreciated the artistry of this. Like, I did. I love that show. It's great. I love to rewatch the old Sopranos episodes, but it's like, you're not building social capital.
But I think like there's like an implicit thing going on here that I want to make a little bit more explicit. Like the charge here from people who are concerned about all this time we're spending alone is that we are opting in to the things that like we think in that moment will make us most happy, whether that's hanging out with your dog rather than going to an uncomfortable happy hour where you have to maybe like mingle with people you don't know and it's awkward. It's choosing to watch Star Trek rather than Felicity. And so like no one else wants to watch with you because no one else is a nerd and a weirdo. And so they're watching cool shows. And like that these kinds of the options that we now have to match us to the exact thing that we want to do isolate us because like, everyone you know around you is different from you. And then the implicit thing there is that like what makes you happy in the short run is actually not what's going to make you fulfilled or happy or whatever in the long run, which kind of raises my next question, which is, are we seeing that people themselves are unhappy with the situation they find themselves in? And I ask this, like, we just released a new poll here at The Argument, which is mostly about elites. But one question I tacked on at the end was asking people whether they would describe themselves as a lonely person. And only 7% of people said that they would definitely describe themselves as a lonely person. 38% said no, not at all. In the middle, you had 23% saying yes to some extent and another 30 saying no, not really. So vast majority of people are saying no. Like 70% roughly are saying no, not at all or not really. I'm a lonely person. You can look more at these like gradients a bit, which are interesting, which indicate that younger people are slightly more likely to feel this way. So you have 3% of 65 plus saying they're definitely a lonely person, but and 13% of 18 to 29 year olds saying that they're definitely a lonely person. So like there's like some story here, obviously, that you could say. But I'm just curious, like in general, when you're looking at this data, Derek, like do you find that like people are really unhappy with the choices they're making?
Yeah, so there's three really interesting pieces that you guys have put on the table in your last two comments and questions. And I just want to make sure that my answer does my best to tack off all three. First, Jerusalem, on the point of a small minority of Americans say that they're lonely, that's a really, really important and I think under-remarked on fact. That it's very, very difficult, if you're trying to be scientific about this, to prove that loneliness itself is rising. It's much easier to prove two other things. Number one, that alone time is rising. And number two, that Americans, especially the Americans that are spending, that are seeing the largest declines in socialization, are less happy than they used to be. So loneliness is, I mean, sociologically or psychologically, like a very specific thing. It's a felt disconnection between your experienced social connection and your desired social connection. So people, you know, I can be at home, you know, reading Freedom from Fear by David M. Kennedy and like just having the best time learning about the New Deal and not feel lonely at all, even though there's no one around me. I can also, and everyone's had this experience, I think, like go to a party and be surrounded by like 50 people and feel heartbreakingly alone because there's no one there to talk to or someone's just hurt my feelings, right? So you can be very lonely around other people. You can be not lonely all by yourself. Loneliness is the feeling of this disconnect between what you're experiencing and what you want. And I think basically what's happened is that a lot of technology in particular, a lot of convenience has made it harder for us to feel that like ancient biological cue to feel lonely. And as a result, we're not getting off the couch. We're not spending time, you know, watching the equivalent, experiencing the equivalent of a Felicity rerun with friends we might not really want to do, but actually doing it is going to create a memory that's going to be valuable for us and create friendships that will serve us in the long run. So I am much more concerned, not about the fact that expressed loneliness is increasing, but I'm concerned about the fact that it's not increasing. And that tells me that as aloneness increases and as unhappiness increases, we're not feeling that cue to fix the unhappiness by reducing our aloneness. Like that's the main problem here. Matt's observation also pulls at this theme that I think I'm like constantly wrestling with around my work, which is that like the most interesting things to write about in society are when human values are pitted against each other. So I write a lot about the costs of optimization culture in health. Like I'm very interested in that right now. Because on the one hand, of course we should want to be healthy. It's like very weird to hope that you get unhealthy, to like want to die earlier. But there are absolutely ways in which if all you want to do is like optimize for like HRV and resting heart rate in the minute before you go to bed, well, in that case, you would never see anybody or have any social experience after like 8 p.m. or 9 p.m. You would certainly never drink. You would never go to a party. In fact, according to the Aura data, nothing correlates more negatively.
Derek and I are wearing our Aura rings right now. So
nothing correlates sponsor more us. Negatively. Yeah, sponsor us Aura just before your IPO. Nothing correlates more negatively with heart rate variability getting worse than going to a party. But here we have a world in which, like, if what you wanted to do was optimize for your health, you would, like, not socialize with people. But in the long run, social connections are incredibly, like, good for you from a, like, neural protective standpoint and also just from a, you know, life includes misery and sometimes it's just good to be around other people standpoint. So I'm always really interested in when you have human values that are in tension. And Matt, I think, put his finger on one way that this exposes a tension in our human values. On the one hand, it's just awesome from a dopaminergic or just happiness standpoint to be able to watch whatever you want to watch whenever you want to watch it. But at the same time, if you were just doing your best to never experience a single feeling that was outside of your instinct to just like see everything you want to see at the moment you want to see it, well, then maybe you would just spend much, much less time with other people. And in that case, you're cutting yourself off from social connection. So I'm just interested in the way that sometimes the decisions that we have made on like a day-by-day basis add up into lives that we're living that are making us less happy. And that leads to the final point that I wanted to talk about, which is like, well, why is it bad that we spend more time alone? Well, you can sort of answer this at like three really quick levels. One, at like a vibe level, like doesn't it just like kind of seem vibe-wise like people aren't doing great and might like a major social phenomenon like historical declines in social connection play a role in that? That's a vibe argument. There's a correlational argument, which is that the groups that are seeing the largest declines in social connection also seem the saddest and most miserable and the most, in some cases, from a political standpoint, revolutionary in wanting to change everything about the way America's political system works. But then finally, we have like some randomized studies where Nick Epley, a scientist at the University of Chicago, has like forced, in some cases, people to be social against their will and then surveyed them and found that they're like happier in that moment than people who were not forced to be social.
I can't believe the IRB allowed that. They just let them torture people like that.
The IRB tortured people by forcing them to. Yeah, they were forced to talk to people on a commuter trains on the L in Chicago. And so basically, you there is some. This is it's hard to do this in a large scale way. But there are some RCTs that essentially show that forcing people to be a little bit more social than they want to be makes them happier in the moment.
So we should take a quick break for ads. Aura, if you're listening to this, reach out. We'd be happy to have you as a sponsor on the show. But we'll be right back.
The Argument is brought to you by Forkful. Eating well can be difficult when life gets busy. Finding time for meal planning and cooking can be a challenge. A lot of meal kits, you know, promise convenience, but they require all kinds of prep and cleanup. Takeout and processed food can sacrifice quality ingredients and taste. A Forkful offers meals that prioritize flavor, function, and health. There's no seed oils. They are chef-cooked. They're fresh, never frozen, ready-to-eat meals. They're made with high-quality premium proteins. That's like grass-fed bison, wild-caught salmon, fresh vegetables. They They've got all different kinds of delicious menus. And the message here is that eating well does not need to be complicated when you can get fully prepared, deliciously healthy meals. No cooking, no meal prep, just clean flavors. They're ready in under 3 minutes and they're delivered to your door within 24 to 48 hours. I've really enjoyed a couple of my Forkful meals that I've been trying. I really enjoyed some pulled pork, some mashed plantains and vegetables. There was a great chicken and rice bowl. There's a lot of good stuff here. You don't need to spend any time on it, and you're getting really good, fresh, clean flavors. So check it out. Explore our plans and menu of fresh, ready-to-eat meals at ForkfulMeals.com and use code ARGUMENT to get 50% off your first order. That's ForkfulMeals.com/argument and use promo code ARGUMENT for 50% off. Thanks to Forkful for sponsoring this episode.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
We're back. I write about politics primarily, but I think that the nexus between this question and politics is really interesting, because I feel like the biggest challenge to my preferred approach to politics and public policy, what I hear all the time, is that this kind of like blah meliorist liberalism does not speak to the profound sense of despair and angst amidst the American people. And, you know, some of it you hear from the right. And I think it's at least like easy to understand what right-wing populists are saying, right? Which is that like the ethnic composition of American society has changed and gender roles have changed. And they think that that is bad. But the left challenge to liberalism, I find like harder to parse. You know, I heard Morris Katz, who's, you know, Mamdani's advisor, Graham Platner's advisor. He was on the Ezra Klein show. They were like mostly talking about vetting and very kind of micro politics stuff. But at one point, Katz goes like big macro mode. And he's like, look, Democrats are going to keep losing until we can admit that, you know, we were in the White House for 12 years. We controlled Congress for much of this time. And over the past 17 years, everyone's lives have gotten worse. And like my answer to that, like as a journalist who cares about facts, is like, that's not true, Mr. Katz. Like income is up, inequality is flat or maybe a little bit down, life expectancy is up, crime is down. Like I can just point to all these indicators. But also I acknowledge that he's a political operative and a political strategist. And every political strategist I have ever talked to is like, the absolute worst thing you can do is tell people who are angry about like economic trends that like they're wrong. Right. And like actually things are better than you think. So clearly something is upsetting people. And if you don't want, and I know Jerusalem doesn't want, to just like give in to the right-wing populists and say that like cultural pluralism is making us miserable, it's like, we've got to come up with something, right? That they're like we will agree is like causing agita in society and that we are willing to make some kind of effort to address. And this thing about loneliness and social disconnection, at least to me, it's like, it's the most plausible candidate I can find of like, why actually are all these young people like espousing a kind of hazy political radicalism?
So I just to do like the annoying, non-ironic wonk thing in this moment, because I just like can't let it go. Like when you look at like loneliness or happiness data and you try to figure out like, okay, well, like who is really happy, who's like giving us information on self-reported happiness, like over and over again, it's people who are high income and who are married, right? Like high income way more than anything else. But I don't even mean like high income, like, oh, you need to be like hella rich or whatever. The Gallup survey shows that 55% of adults in household earning at least $100,000 were very satisfied with their personal lives. We wrote an article about this, The Argument, we'll link it in the show notes, a while back, but just like, it is literally true that if the number one thing the government could do to make people happier right now is to improve the economic situation in the country such that people earned more money. And I just like,
But do we know how much that's like an absolute or a relative thing?
We don't know, but I think that it is definitely the case to me. I mean, what I believe is true based on a reading of the data, which you're correct, is not completely, dispositive of this question, is that like, if the government focused on making people wealthier, if it focused on making sure that like scarce goods were, and to be on our hobby horse again, like housing, et cetera, were not scarce, like that would improve people's happiness a ton. Because I do think at core, while there are other things that matter, I'm a religious person. So for me, like God is not dead. So I don't have to deal with these like problems of modernity, like, I don't know, other people do. But, you know, I just think in general, people are underrating how important it is for the government to really focus on improving the material circumstance of people's lives. And it's weird to me that many of the people who are like, we need massive kind of like spiritual change, tons of it on the right, but also again, like, as you know, Matt, you're referencing on the left too, like seem to ignore this materialist, like, I think, correct response. Anyway, that's
But I mean, I'm kind of saying the opposite of that.
No, I know
though.
You're like, saying
like
the opposite.
I agree that material conditions are important.
Yeah.
But like, material conditions and we should continue to improve them, and we should alleviate housing scarcity, all these things. But like, over the past 10 years, the material condition of the median American household has gotten better.
Yeah.
But if you were to say that,
yeah,
in
this
public,
is not political advice. I'm not saying
right. No. I mean, I understand, but like, that is different from like Ronald Reagan in 1984 ran a campaign that was about it's morning in America. Yeah. Bill Clinton in 1996, I forget what the slogan was, but like, it was like status quo, guys, right? Like, there have been times in the recent past when cheerleading for the status quo was a winning message. There have also been times like 2008 when clearly you don't want to cheerlead for the status quo because like, the economy is collapsing. What's weird to me has been the 2016-2024 dynamic where like things actually are getting better, but like nobody believes that things are getting better. Nobody wants to hear that things are getting better. Like something is going on.
I think that people, especially young people who are frustrated with the economy, do have a material case to make, despite the fact that clearly some things are getting better. Like, you know,
yes,
real earnings are higher in 2026 than they were in 2018. Like that is a fact. But also, like, the Wall Street Journal just had this piece that found that 49% of adults under 30 were reporting living with a parent, according to the Federal Reserve's latest survey of household economics and decision making. Almost 50% of adults under 30 are living with a parent. That's up 12 percentage points from the year before the pandemic, 2019. That's not great. I don't think that's like a clear sign of economic health. I wrote a piece in April that was called If America Is So Rich, How'd It Get So Sad? That tried to answer in as clear a way as possible the question that you guys are framing. And the way that I think about it is that there's an economic side and there's like a very clear non-economic side. On the economic side, I think like it's just very hard to underrate like how much people despise inflation, and especially young people despise housing inflation and the impression that they can't afford a house. And like, if you look at the rate of inflation in the 2020s, despite the fact that the, you know, annual inflation rate has come down, if you look at the overall growth in the price of all these things, whether it's consumer staples or housing, the rate of inflation is basically triple in the 2020s what it was in the 2010s through 2000s. So people are just like not used to prices going up this much. And that novel pace of price increase, I think, has really just absolutely cratered consumer sentiment. But I also think that like there's something happening on the non-economic side, on the social side. And it's sort of like, you know, like what is social connection for? Like, what are friends and close connections with family for? Well, you know, love is wonderful and like friendships are wonderful. And it's great to like be able to like go out and have a martini with someone that you like and, you know, gossip about work or, you know, whatever, your favorite podcast. But also I think friends and family are really useful for when things feel shitty.
Yeah.
And in a world where young people feel like they're struggling in their personal lives, but then also are going onto TikTok and Instagram and seeing other people make the case that America in the 2020s is just this rolling dumpster fire of fascism and hell, well, then they're just going to feel terrible no matter where they look. They look at their lives and they think, I'm living with my parents. They look at their phone and they see that the world is burning down. In a world like that, like, you really need friends. You really need to not be alone on a couch looking at your phone and doom scrolling for 5 hours. But right now, that is the way that a lot of people sublimate or exercise their grief is just by spending more time with the very device that's bringing them grief. Like when I was reporting the antisocial century, my wife turned me on to this trend on TikTok called cancelation, which is young people doing a dance when someone cancels a plan on like a Friday or Saturday, right? And of course, like we've all been there, like we've all like had a super busy, annoying week where we had to go to a dinner party on Friday that we really weren't looking forward to, and then they cancel on it, and we're like deep down, we're like, oh, fucking thank God. But also, like we are talking about the statistically the most alone generation in recorded American history, young people in America today. Socializing, making popular and normal, doing a dance when your plans are canceled.
Yeah. Right?
So the most alone generation is dancing when their plans are canceled. There's something weird going on there. There's a fetishization almost of individual alone time and the need to be alone and almost the therapeutic value of not being around other people. And if you're in a period where like prices are high and housing is out of reach and you're living with your parents and your phone is constantly telling you that the world is burning down, and also you feel like the most therapeutic thing that you can do is not be around other people, well, of course you're going to be fucking miserable. That's kind of how I bridge the material and sort of post-material or non-material explanation.
So I want to dig in on like one aspect of the story that you're telling, because I think it's actually gets at what causally might be going on here. Because if people were alone and they were all spending it like reading intensive books and watching like, you know, amazing films from the past 200 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then when they got together, they were all talking about this amazing, enriching alone time, and they were meditating on religious texts and philosophy or whatever. I think that people would be freaking out a lot less. I think what's actually happening here is not like alone time has gone down. It's alone time has been distributed towards an activity, social media, where you're intaking a bunch of, you know, I think bad political and cultural content that's making you feel bad. I mean, whether it's about politics or people are telling you that the only way to be happy and the only way to have a good outcome is to literally burn everything down in a communist kind of revolution, or that women need to go back into a traditional frame of mind. And you have all of these ideas around traditional forms of dating that are flourishing on the internet. We also found evidence of this in our poll about views on gender roles kind of spiking a little bit amongst people who are getting their news most from social media. So I think all of that indicates to me something different is going on here than just like aloneness as core, but really like what people are doing in that alone time. And I think this kind of speaks to something you wrote about for The Argument, but also something that like I've been tracking in other contexts for a while, which is there something specifically about the English speaking world that is causing these problems? I mean, one thing that we do see, I mean, there was a great piece, which I've not like looked into the data of myself, but I will link it in the show notes, where someone was talking about how people in Spain still read. They were responding to the recent piece about the end of reading is here. And they look at a study in Spain about readership, which finds that the overall Spanish population that reads for pleasure has increased every year since 2017, reaching 66% in 2025, the highest level ever recorded. The percentage of the population between 15 and 24 that reads for pleasure rose to just over 76%, a rate that, in the words of the authors, helps dispel one of the false myths that persists in our society that holds that young people do not read. And like all this reason to be like, and again, like obviously the Anglo world, we're all in it. It's the best part of the world. We love it. We're fantastic. It's really important what goes on there. It's also important because it seems to influence the rest of the world on some sort of like timescale. So maybe like Spanish youths will like pick up English memes in like 10 years or whatever. But I just like wonder here, like, do we really care about aloneness? Are we just like mad about social media, political and cultural commentary?
Yeah, I do think we care about aloneness, because I think one of the strongest arguments about the smartphone and social media isn't just that the things that we're doing on the smartphone are bad, is that the things that we're doing are displacing other things that are better for us and more meaningful, and that we don't regret afterward. Like a piece that is like on my whiteboard that I've been trying to write for like 6 weeks, but other shit keeps happening, is about like what concept of like the regret economy. Mm. Like leisure time didn't used to be so filled with regret. Like, I don't think that people in the 19th century, like, deeply regretted the time that they spent reading George Eliot. They weren't like, I feel so guilty about, like, all that Middlemarch time. Or like, oh, I went to the concert to, like, see Brahms, and, like, it was 3 hours, and I feel, I shouldn't have done that. I wasted an evening.
I think your vision of leisure time is a little highbrow here.
Well, but think about how common it is. Think about how normalized it is for people to talk about deeply regretting the most common leisure activities. Like, I do wonder, and now I'm just completely speculating. This is not based on research I've done. I wonder whether even the concept of a guilty pleasure is a fairly modern concept. Like, was pleasure always wrapped up with this idea of guilt? And there's a whole different episode to do on the relationship between guilt and leisure in the modern economy. I'm really fascinated by it. But it goes to this idea that, like, when you spend time on your phone, that's time that we classically regret. Like, the next day, when I'm like, Jerusalem, how much fun did you have spending, like, you know, going on TikTok for, you know, 3 hours? You have a dumb phone now. So I'm guessing, like, you don't love the time that you spend scrolling on TikTok, not to reveal secrets for
your
large
audience. So
I don't think it is as common to talk publicly about the time that you regret getting drinks with your friends, playing board games with your friends, having dinner with your family. And so if what we're fundamentally doing in our lives by spending more time on our phones and less time around other people is trading an activity that we regret for an activity that we never regret, well, then obviously it seems like that's a worse situation. So I'm very interested in that phenomenon. On the issue of the Anglosphere, this is like one of my favorite, as Matt said, like I'm obsessed with like social trends, and this is one of the social trends that I find like most delicious. Like, according to the World Happiness Report, which is like one of the, you know, top reports at looking at the direction of happiness around the world, I talked to John Helliwell, who's a co-author of the report, and he told me, this is a quote, "If you're looking for something that's special about the countries where youth unhappiness is rising, they're mostly Western developed countries, and for the most part, they are countries that speak English. If you look at the change in happiness score between 2012 and 2025, where happiness has fallen the most, it's fallen the most in Canada, Australia, Norway, the United States, New Zealand, the UK, Ireland. It's increased. Happiness has increased in Portugal, Italy, Spain, Germany. It's falling the most in the English-speaking countries and not in the less English-speaking countries. And one further test that you can do of this is you can look at happiness in Ontario versus Quebec, which is something that Helliwell has done. Two provinces, same country. In one province, they speak all English. In another province, like 96% of them speak French. And in fact, the declines in happiness are shallower in Quebec than they are in Ontario. I think a lot of things are happening here. I think the U.S. has a culture of hyper-individualism, diagnostic inflation, which is a fancy way of saying I think we pathologize a lot of fairly normal behavior. We encourage people to think that normal modes of thought or intrusive thoughts are signs of anxiety disorders and ADHD and other mental health disorders. I think that increases what my wife, an actual clinical psychologist, calls interoception, that is paying attention to your own thoughts and bodily sensations. I think that being obsessed with the idea that you might have an anxiety disorder encourages you to focus on the ways that you might have an anxiety disorder in a way that might not necessarily be healthy. And I think we have, and Matt has talked about this a lot, extremely high levels, historically unusually high levels of negativity in our news coverage. And basically, I think that America has taken that like nauseous brew of bad stuff and put it on social media and export it to the world like it's Mickey Mouse or Coca-Cola. And that I think the same way that there's some evidence that anorexia is a Western phenomenon that we essentially exported to Eastern Asia, where there's like no record of anorexia nervosa before globalization. I think we are very potentially exporting an American brand of misery to the world. And the first countries being infected by it are the English-speaking ones, and eventually all those not so unhappy young Spanish people are going to get on American social media as well. And then unfortunately, I think we might make them sad too. But that is frankly what I think is happening. I think America is basically like creating and exporting a mode of experiencing reality that is bad for us. And it's like the It's like the evil Coca-Cola of the 21st century.
I want to just call out the Quebec example there and its significance, because it's sort of well known that the Anglophone countries differ in various ways from the rest of the world. I mean, those are all rich countries, but we also tend to have like more flexible labor markets than Western Europe. You know, if you do, I took a comparative welfare states class in college, and like the Anglophone countries is like a block there, right? And so two things that are interesting. One is that Norway is on the Anglophone pattern, mm-hmm. and that Quebec is not, right? And so Quebec is politically, economically, constitutionally, institutionally integrated into Anglophone Canada. Norway is a completely different underlying social model and sociological trajectory. But Norway's a really small country. Very few people speak Norwegian, and very high levels of education. So Norwegians are highly exposed to English language content. And we have a lot of like liquidity between Norway and the Anglosphere in cultural terms. We have a Norwegian actress in Backrooms, like one of the big hit movies of the summer. So those two things are evidence that it is the English language content. Mm-hmm. Right, rather than something that correlates with speaking English, because mm-hmm. because almost everything about Quebec is similar to the rest of Canada, but they're speaking French, they're watching different TV shows, they are, it's not that they don't use social media, but they're watching segmented French language social media. And so the question is like, English is the leading edge of global culture. Right, Hollywood movies, the American music industry lead the world. We have the most kind of like liquid media market in the universe. And the question is like, well, if it turns out that this kind of like relentless negativity gives you a competitive advantage, will that just hop into like French social media, Spanish social media, et cetera? You know, Jerusalem mentioned that people still read in Spain. I looked up the literacy statistics, and Spain and the United States have similar levels of literacy today. But if you go back 50 years, there was about a 15 percentage point gap. And if you go back 100 years, there was a huge gap, right? Spain is like literally behind the United States in mass education and mass literacy. And so they are like arguably just like where we were a generation ago in terms of like people's intergenerational experience of mastering reading and like reading as like a social art and things like that. So it could be that Spain and the United States will go on totally different trajectories with regard to reading, or it could also be that Spain will just continue to be 30 years behind the United States. And like, we are post-literate. They are now like late 20th century. But you know, we'll follow us on this kind of trajectory. And, you know, also like AI could easily like redub, you know, our podcast probably into Italian. Or, you know, if you can't do that right away, you'll be able to in 6 months. And, you know, it makes me worry, and it is distinct from people spending time alone. But like in practice, they're one and the same. Like, this is what people are doing when they're alone. And it's also the main reason that they are spending more time alone.
Well, like, sorry, to be clear, I do think that like the reason why this matters, this distinction matters, is because like, even if you were to, like, we're talking about a matter of a few hours a week, right? Like, it would be a massive sea change difference if a few hours a week more people were spending it with friends rather than with family. But even if you spent like a few more hours a week at a bar rather than on your phone, like, you're still going to be on your phone like a lot. Like, you're still ingesting like a ton of this information, this cultural output, this product, whatever, is going to be in your brain a lot. Like, potentially those few hours a week of like whatever socializing you're doing inoculate you in some sense from the messaging you're getting from social media. But I think that's like probably not the case. I think it's probably the case that like you probably would be slightly happier. You'd have some of these other benefits that Derek has talked about, but also you would still have this like genuine like mass negativity bias and this framework for viewing the world we think is unhealthy. And so I think that like it is important here that like it is very possible to imagine just like better things being said on social media that make people happier. If there's a study or something we could do where like, you know, you just assign certain types of content to people's phones for a period of time. Very, very difficult, I'm sure, to like actually standardize. But I actually think this is important here, because as someone who is an alone time defender, I still think it's really valuable to me in person. Like, the argument is an in-person workplace. I think it's good for people to interact with each other. I also get a lot of time with other people, like whether it's on this podcast with you two, but also just like in general, you have to interact with people all the time. But I like being alone, and I just, and maybe that's like making me a little biased here, but I don't really view this to be a big problem if these statistics go up, if what people are doing in that time is valuable.
Well, let me just say to that, like, I think we always have to keep front of mind when we're asking why is this bad, the fact that according to whether it's, you know, Consumer Survey or World Happiness Report or the General Social Survey, practically every single survey finds that happiness in America has declined significantly, not only in the last few decades, but in particular in the last few years, in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years.
And especially among younger people.
And especially among young people. And so, like, if I found those American time use study statistics, that American alone time was increasing, but we were living in a period where there was, like, no discourse vibe that people were unhappy. And according to the General Social Survey, happiness was just going up. And according to, like, University of Michigan, like, consumer sentiment, people were, like, really happy with the economy. And according to, like, World Happiness Survey, like, Americans were, like, way happier now than, you know, any other country in the world. Like, then what story would I have to write? It's like, well, I guess we're spending more time alone, and, like, we freaking love it, and it's the best. And, like, we should definitely cut out even more of our friends and, like, see how far we can push this train, you know? But that's not the world in which this phenomenon is happening. One point that I wanted to make in one of my last answers, but that you keep triggering in my head, I keep because you're circling one of my favorite ideas, is that our alone time. I think alone time is, like, incredibly precious and incredibly sacred. I think maybe particularly parents of young children value alone time in, like, a very special way, because, like, time in the home is, like, so chaotic that when I'm on a work trip and I get to, like, go to sleep alone and wake up alone and, Jesus Christ, have breakfast alone, like, have dinner alone, have a glass of cab alone, like, it is so rare and, like, just delicious and luxurious, and I love it. Alone time, like, you know, many other therapies, is fantastic in the right dose. But there's something interesting about alone time in our technological age, which is that it's contaminated. Our alone time is more contaminated by the thoughts of other people than it used to be. And also, our time with other people can often be more alone than it used to be. Because at any moment, if we go to a party and we feel like wanting to be like a wallflower, we have the ability to, like, pull out our phone and be somewhere else. And so there's something really interesting that's also going on, that, like, the quality of our alone time is not as truly alone as it used to be, and that therefore it isn't, like, providing, I think, the same kind of respite that it can or has historically provided. Like, I try very much when I'm traveling and, like, having that, you know, breakfast alone. Like, I try to, like, get a newspaper or a book to, like, do something that allows me to experience my aloneness, like, in a really, really pure way, and not just to, like, get into a fight with someone who's tweeting something mean at Matt. And then in that moment, like, I could be at, you know, a Ritz in San Francisco. I could be in my living room. I could be anywhere in the world if my entire emotional, psychological energy is just going toward winning a fight with a person on the internet I will never meet. Like, that's a very specific way in which I think, like, modern aloneness, the promise of aloneness is like not fully destroyed, but complicated by the fact that we actually don't really spend our alone time to be alone. A lot of us spend our alone time to be inside the minds of influencers and people on social media.
I guess the one thing I would say that's, like, the opposite of some of this, I've been thinking about, I've been here in Maine all summer. And last summer when I was up here, I had guests, like, constantly, which was fun. Like, I saw a lot of friends, et cetera, et cetera. This year, for various reasons, fewer people have come up to see us. And I was kind of worried, you know, like, I know some people up here, but not nearly as many as I do in DC. And I thought, I'm going to be so isolated. I'm going to be bored out of my mind. And one thing that is nice about modern technology is that I am much less cut off from both, like, people who I know. You know, I mean, I can work remotely thanks to Slack and stuff, but it's just like I'm still on all my text chains with my friends. I am, like, checking in with different people about different things. There's more like social liquidity. So other people who are like vaguely passing through this part of the state know that I am here, are able to get in touch with me easily. I can see them. It's like, it's easier to keep in touch with people. But also, you know, I can pop in on Twitter on any given night and take the pace of what like my usual parasocial friend, you know, some of these are people who I know in real life. Some of them are total strangers, but I'm still like connected to the discourse worlds that I participate in. And so it's like holding all else constant, I feel like this technology makes us less lonely, right? Like, right. The paradox is that it's in equilibrium, like causes you to spend less time socializing than you would if it didn't exist. But given like where you are and what, and, you know, like I'm not going to turn my whole life upside down over 6 weeks. Like it's hard to make new friends, right? So like if you happen to be physically remote from your friends, digital technology makes it way easier to feel connected to them or connected to somebody. But like in the long run, maybe makes it less likely that you'll find these kind of connections, which again, I mean, is why I'm interested in the youth trends, right? Because the rest of us can sort of like spend down social capital that was formed in the years of like going to a party as a friend of a friend, and all these other kinds of things. And it's like, once you have the connections, this is a convenient way to keep in touch with people. But then the question is like, are you making them? You know, Jerusalem's doing okay. You're surviving.
Yeah, I've made it. I do think that like it's worth talking. I mean, I find that a lot of people are having conversations about loneliness now, and it's worth talking a little bit about like what you guys actually think would fix this or what would improve it. Like I personally, I have a couple of things that I believe. Like one is I think that like addictive waves tend to be metabolized by society on like slightly long time scale. So when you're in the middle of it, it feels like apocalyptic, but then people like figure out ways of managing it in various ways. And I think like cigarettes is an example of this. Obviously it took a massive like whole of government effort through PSAs and through whatever. Like it was not like nothing, you don't like rest on your laurels, do nothing. I think we're like at the beginning of this is like a, hey parents, it's like quite bad to let your kids be addicted to this kind of technology. I have like a friend I've talked about on the podcast before who works with kids with various disabilities in public schools. And, you know, she finds it very, very difficult whenever she has to raise conversations all the time with parents about their kids' screen time use. And she finds it very, very difficult to have these conversations because parents are so like increasingly now really sensitive to someone raising it because they are for the first time realizing how bad it is. And so we're at the very beginning of this wave of culturally through our public institutions pushing back on it. I imagine, I mean, obviously there's all these questions about various policy shifts you could do to reduce the time spent on social media by young people, et cetera. And I also just think that like, there are now technological fixes that are coming up. Like I personally, as someone who, I mean, I don't know if quote unquote social media addiction is a real thing, but like short form content to me is like a drug in a way that like nothing else has been. And I found myself in, you know, COVID era 2020, like being like, one-shotted by TikTok and just like willing to spend, I mean, on some days, like 8 hours, 10 hours a day, like on TikTok when I look at my screen time and just like not sleeping as a result. And, you know, in order to fix this, I bought a dumb phone. I was like, this is like really bad. Like I don't have self-control over this. Some people can set like these limits. Some people can like have the little brick thing and like lock their phone for a couple hours a day and they're fine. And I was like, but it's not for me. Like I can't do that. So like I need to buy this new technology, which was like the dumb phone I have, like works pretty well. Like sometimes it just like stops working and that's like quite annoying. And I have to rely on the fact that other people in my life have a smartphone or, and it's also like just very early in this technology, but like we're seeing more and more of these kinds of technological fixes to the problem come up. And I think to me, like when I think about solutions to this broad concerns around happiness and alone time and loneliness, et cetera, like it largely is going to be like what taking very seriously that people need to spend less time on their phones, having kind of a whole of government, still like kind of small illiberal approach to that, recognizing the technological change is going to be a part of that shift. And also, again, to return to my hobby horse, returning to like the very basics of what makes people happy, which is access to the freedom that income and housing actually provide. So I don't know how you guys are thinking about this. Like maybe you guys view like more drastic interventions as necessary, but that's me.
No, I think you pretty much outlined the way that I think about it. There's a material side and there's like a cultural side. On the cultural side, I'm very fond of the concept of social fitness, because I like the idea of thinking about socializing as akin to exercise. Actual fitness is something that where you are purposeful about often scheduling exercises, about taking breaks from the norm to like do something that isn't in your house sometimes, maybe you have a home gym. But like fitness for most people is like a very like intentional thing that is planned. And I think that like building friendships is something that in many cases like has to be planned. Like I love Matt's idea that it's wonderful to be in your 40s and be able to, you know, be in a house in Maine where not a lot of people are coming by, but you have all these friends that are on group chats and on DMs that and you've built these friendships over years and decades, and now you can sort of spend down those relationships. The problem is precisely that young people have significantly fewer friends than previous generations and spend way less time around those friends than other people. So when they're Matt's age and they're in their proverbial Maine homes or wherever else, like they're not going to have, I think, the relationships that geriatric millennials and Gen Xers have. And so I'm a huge fan of thinking about socializing as akin to fitness and like making specific plan. Like not only like, I want to make sure that I like go to the gym like twice a week. I love the idea of people saying like, I want to make sure that I like socialize outside of my home, even when life's really, really busy, a certain amount of times a week or a month to force myself to continue to nurture friendships that will not only be wonderful in the short run, but will also pay dividends down the line. On the material side, like this isn't like, I hope this isn't like too hot takey, but at some point, you know, I want to be clear about what problem I'm trying to solve. Like, I want people to be happier. And so I'm very interested in, like, what seems to make people happy? Hard question. Ancient philosophical question. Okay, what seems to correlate with happiness? Two of the things that correlate with happiness the most, and I think you've already raised them, are income and marriage. And income and marriage aren't exactly unrelated. Marriage rates are highest, especially where... not only all wages are high, but also specifically real income, real wage income growth for men is high because women are less likely to marry down. And so in areas or communities where male wages are stagnating, that tends to be where you see a coupling decline. So I think there's also just like a really clear case of just like trying to increase wages for everybody and caring a lot about overall economic growth. I don't think economic growth itself is obviously some kind of panacea for aloneness because we've had economic growth and aloneness rise in tandem. But, you know, if happiness is what we're trying to build at the end of the day, then giving people financial security, making it easier for them to buy a home, making it easier for them to have the kind of life that they associate with success, like that's incredibly important. So I try to think about solving this on both like the material side and the cultural side.
Matt, do you have radical takes on what we should do?
No, you know, I mean, I think that we
you
should...
You still want to do the broadband tracks, right? You want to tax
Well, them. I mean, I do think that we should consider, like, if we have a view that people are like over-consuming, certain kinds of things that we should, you know, rethink how our tax base works and things like that. But I actually think like more profound than any policy measure related to loneliness or social disconnection or social media is just, I would like elites in the United States of America to be cognizant of the fact that this is what is happening. Right now, some of that is for like, as Derek was saying, right? It's like once you, there was a time, like nobody exercised in the 1830s. You just like worked, you know, like you did physical labor all day. And there would have come a time when like probably not nearly enough people were exercising. And we had to like learn that, okay, it's like, it's good to not be doing hard physical labor your whole life, but like also you have to lift heavy objects in a structured way or else like your bones collapse. So that's good. But also like, I think that we've politically been in this very unproductive spiral in which like smart, intelligent, perceptive people who care about politics and they care about policy and like they want to win, they want to practice democracy, right? Like they want to like speak to people's anxieties, keep convincing themselves that there must be some dramatic, like really engaging economic policy shift that like they have to make. And then we have to like keep asserting that we're in like decades of failed neoliberalism or something like that. But if you just know in the back of your head that like, yes, like as always, like it's good for people to have rising wages rather than falling, you know, like it's good to have growth rather than not growth. But that like also people are just spending way more time marinating in social media and it's like making them feel kind of unhappy. Whether or not you have like a policy to address that fact, if you just are cognizant of the fact that that's what's happening, like you will make different choices about what you do.
Like what? Right? Like what do you mean?
Like
what else is there to do other than look at social media?
Yeah.
Well, it's just like you won't assume that like we need to overhaul our trade policy. Because like that doesn't impact it, right? You know what I mean? Like it's just if you feel strongly that there's some like dark matter out there, you'll keep grasping at straws. If you can identify that the dark matter is negativity on social media, then like maybe you can fix that, maybe you can't, but at least you won't come up with like fake diagnoses. You won't throw babies out with the bathwater, right? You'll see that like actually in the realm of populist politicians, some of them are like cheery populists and some of them are like really dour populists. And both styles can work, but the cheery style is just like probably better, right? Like if the actual thing is just like a vibes-based void, then like finding people who are upbeat rather than people who are really, really angry, you know, will be good. And that there's this idea out there that like, well, what we need more of in our politics is to like name and shame enemies. And I'm really skeptical of that. You know, like the biggest enemy, whether we're talking about social media use, we're talking about gambling, we're talking about like overeating, lack of exercise, whatever, it's just like our own weakness of the will. You know, which like we all suffer from. I think we're all can like sympathize with that everybody makes choices that are kind of like, eh. And, you know, we're living in a, like an affluent postmodern condition in which we can all be sort of short-sighted. And we like maybe need more guardrails around that stuff or maybe need to be like more forgiving of ourselves and more forgiving of each other. But there's not like an evil shadowy conspiracy to like make you watch more TikTok. It's like, we'd like it. Like
actually we're contravening federal law right now by allowing TikTok. So
well,
there
fair
is,
enough.
There is a conspiracy.
But it's, you know, it's like, I don't use TikTok, but you know, so I'll like watch Instagram reels and then I'll wake up the next day and I'll be like, man, I'm really tired. And I'd be like, well, am I tired because I was partying till 3 a.m. having the time of my life? And it's like, no. Am I tired because I was burning the midnight oil working? It's like, no. I'm tired because I was like watching winter camping videos. And that's like not a good idea. Like it would just be better to sleep.
So the same way like Bernie has like the fight oligarchy tour, should you and I go on the road and have like a fight weakness of the will tour? We just go around speaking to like barely populated college auditoriums.
The Ecrasia tour.
This Nietzschean message of fight weakness of the will. I mean, I'm in fundamental agreement that like this is a major ingredient in American unhappiness. And I am in agreement that there's something important about just like naming a phenomenon. Like, you know, I don't think that smartphones are cigarettes. I don't think that's like a particularly close analogy. I think smartphones have like a utility that cigarettes don't particularly have. But it was the knowledge that cigarettes could be cancerous beyond any law that was created to say ban cigarette ads from broadcast television that created the move against cigarettes and also created a kind of social vocabulary around cigarettes, right? Like people telling other people like, hey, don't smoke around me, secondhand smoke, that can also be cancerous. And so I do think that, you know, despite the thing that I said earlier about the material and the cultural, I think there's just like a language component here too, that just like naming the fact of certain social ills like is its own necessary step, because once people are aware of it, then I think sometimes their behavior changes automatically.
Derek, thank you so much for coming on the show. This was fantastic. We'll have to have you back on soon.
My pleasure. I'll see you in, like 45 seconds.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
stick around. Matt and I are still going to do a peer review and talk about our new paper. But thanks again.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
All right, we're back with some peer review. I saw hot off the presses in the NBER Digest, a paper that features two of my favorite things, Swedish administrative data and exploiting of random assignment to judges as a causal instrument. It is called Life After Divorce, Effects of Joint Custody on Parents and Children. This paper has a boatload of co-authors, Stella Canessa, Gordon B. Dahl, Anna Hasselqvist, Kostas Megier, Susan Nicknami, Martin Palm, Helmut Rayner, Olaf Rosenqvist, and Peng-Peng Shao.
Byline inflation has hit NBER.
They really threw a lot of people at this research project. Okay, so here's what they wanted to do. They wanted to understand what happens to mothers and fathers as a result of custody assignments in divorce proceedings. They go to Sweden because there is rich administrative data, so you can get fine-grained information about this. And what they do is they show that different judges have sort of different propensity at the margin to assign sole or joint legal custody. And so then you can tell based on what judge you were assigned to, right? You're getting essentially random assignment to judges is how the Swedish legal system works. And then you could do a bunch of math. And what they show is that if a father is awarded joint custody of a child, they end up with better mental health and better job earnings than if they are denied joint custody. And then they show that for mothers, there is no impact. Then they have various speculations as to why that might be. But actually, the data that they have is not really strong enough to tell you that much about why it may be. But they do have a pretty good causal research design. I mean, you might think obviously that like fathers who apply for joint custody of their children but are denied it are like probably fuck ups. And it's not super duper surprising necessarily that they may not succeed in other domains of life. But there's like a good randomization here. And so they're showing that being assigned the joint custody leads you to do better in other kind of realms because you're more connected with your children, maybe.
There's some selection issues here, obviously, which I think are impossible to get around outside of, unethical research practices. But like the set of people that they're examining are people who did not automatically default to joint custody. Like the default in Sweden and I believe in America now, but I'm not sure, it is joint custody. And so like most people who are getting a divorce will like default to that option. And so the people who cannot agree on that for whatever reason are the ones who are now being considered, which like speaks to like there's already like probably more serious than average problems in this relationship if like you couldn't just agree to joint custody and like follow along with that plan, like you needed to go to this court hearing to have a judge adjudicate it. So there is that like one that is like a big kind of thing hanging over the results of this paper. And another thing I want to point out here, which I found kind of confusing. So custody as they're measuring it in this context is referring to like whether or not someone has the right to make a legal decision. So like, can you switch someone's school without both parents signing off? Medical decisions, who gets to make those sorts of things, etc. And like the thing that most people think about when they're thinking about custody, and even in this paper, right? Like in this paper, they're talking about the context of custody as being, you know, children having to deal with inconsistent parenting styles, having to divided living arrangements. Like people are often thinking about like literally like, where are you living? Like, are you living in two different places at once? And what are the transition costs that are associated with that? What are the other costs associated with that, mental health or otherwise, for kids and their parents? There's also obviously concerns about having to force parents to be in proximity with each other all the time who may not have a good relationship. And this paper like can speak to that maybe like a little bit. I assume it's associated, like having joint custody is like associated with spending more time with your kid, but like it's not actually measuring that. And they don't explain anywhere in the paper that they have evidence that like there's a high percentage of people who have joint legal custody who are also spending time with their children. And this actually like unlocks something that I was thinking about with this paper, because when you first brought it up, I was like, wow, like kind of interesting that like joint custody has really all these benefits for the dad, but like nothing for the mom. Seems a little bit weird. Like, what's going on there? And what I'm imagining is that like joint legal custody does not actually mean that 50% of the parenting time is being borne equally by both parents. It probably means is like in many contexts that like the dad sees this kid sometimes, but like mom is still doing the majority of the work. And so like, of course there aren't like major like mental health benefits accruing to moms if like it goes from, yeah, you have your kids 100% of the time to like you now are solo parenting 80% of the time. And like every once in a while you have to see your ex who you have a problem with and like worry about what's going on over there versus like dads who went from I'm being denied hanging out with my kids to now like, oh, I am recognized as a father. I'm still involved in their lives. I can see them sometimes, but I don't actually have to carry like the massive burden of like parenting day in and day out. And like, I wonder like if that is what's going on here and like how much this paper can even really speak to like how people should think about joint custody in like a residential sense. If it's just a legal sense, this seems like it speaks to that, but I don't know how much that matters.
Yeah. So I mean, to just delve into that a little bit more, right? In the United States, we have the concept of joint legal custody, which means you are like co-decision makers on behalf of the child. And we also have the concept of joint physical custody. And in most states, joint physical custody is defined as a more or less 50-50 time split. And then there's like these different menus of joint custody schedules that parents sort of choose from. And at least in my parenting social circles, when people use the vernacular term joint custody, they are normally referring to joint physical custody. And so that'll be either like week on, week off, or these kind of more complex pulses. What they're talking about in this study is joint legal custody. And apparently in the Swedish legal framework, the physical custody is not normally litigated, right? So that it's if you have unitary legal custody, then the legal custodian can unilaterally decide on a physical custody arrangement. So like, it doesn't mean that dad never sees the kid necessarily, yeah. But it could mean that. Yeah. It could mean anything. Yeah. And then joint legal custody also doesn't mean 50-50 time splitting.
Yeah.
That an arrangement where the kid's with the mom almost every weekday, is with the dad alternate weekends and like some school vacations, which I would not normally call joint. That's not like how I am accustomed to using that word, but that kind of arrangement could be joint custody in the Swedish, you know, divorce law context. So, right. Like one possibility is that this is all being driven by that kind of like easy mode dad lifestyle where you see the kid on the weekends doing fun stuff, but also not every weekend. So you also have like time to go do whatever. And, you know, you get to feel like you're an involved parent, but you're not doing the scut work of like, you know, what's for dinner tonight after work. Maybe.
I mean, there are two things that speak against that. One is that it clearly impacts mobility of fathers, they find. So like fathers and mothers are more likely to like live near each other, which indicates to me that like you're seeing your, like it's correlating with seeing your kids sometimes. And the other is that, which I found really interesting, getting joint custody increases. I want to find the exact, 3 years after a ruling, fathers have a 14 percentage point higher chance of remarriage if they get joint custody, which indicates that, you know, not to cast too many aspersions on the character of these Swedish fathers, but that like these are men who are looking for a partner who can help them take care of their kids. And
okay, that was not my interpretation.
Is your interpretation they have time to like dick around and so they can like, you know, date?
No. I mean, my interpretation was that, you know, if you are at a certain age and you are in the whatever dating market of people who it is of that age, that it's like the involved, connected father just seems like a more responsible.
Oh, that's coming from our own biases. That's a really good interpretation. A better candidate. Yeah.
Because it's always, you know, I mean, of course, you know, the issue anybody faces at a certain age is it's like, well, are you like a total weirdo who nobody could stand? Right. And like never, it's like, that's not great. But it's like, well, you're divorced, but it's like, that's like a little bit of a red flag. But it's like,
just catching strays to members of our audience, I'm sure.
No. But like divorced, but joint custody is like, okay, you know, like not everything works out. Like you're a responsible person. You're like pulling your weight in society.
Yeah. That's a positive interpretation. As opposed to
like, yeah, I have a child, but I never see him.
Yeah.
That's like...
One thing I'll say is like, I am like, I don't know. I think that lots of people who are interested in joint, you know, in the impact of divorce are like, totally fine, interested in what happens to the mother and father. Like, I'm like much more interested in what happens to the children because I feel like this is like kind of an innocent party that was not responsible for whatever happened to
them. You care about the children.
I do care about the children.
Think about the children. Yeah.
Such an embarrassing thing to admit. So I mean, this paper speaks a little bit to that. They find that there are like benefits. They can't find like any kind of mental health harms to this, which you might think that like if kids are forced to move around between their parents a lot or see an abusive, you know, parent or whatever it is, like that would be a problem. They don't find any negative consequences. They do find a bunch of positive educational consequences, which I find very interesting. They find that children assigned to joint custody exhibit 47% of a standard deviation higher test scores, and they're also more likely to attend higher quality primary schools. And when you look at the gender shifts, it's much better for girls than boys. Lots of counterintuitive findings. I'm not really sure how to interpret all of that. I assume that part of this is like maybe joint custody means that parents, that you have two parents who are financially involved in your future more. So maybe you're attending the better schools that way. Maybe there's something about, you know, fathers being more engaged in their daughters' lives psychologically has benefits. I thought there was all this research coming out about how like dads are really, really helpful for their sons. They speculate in the paper that maybe it's the case that what's wrong with, you know, if something's going wrong with young boys, it's already baked in by the time joint custody is happening. So perhaps it has no effect, but I don't know. It was interesting. I'm glad they didn't find any negative stuff happening to kids. They don't really look into like everything you might care about, but that's positive.
Now, here my flag in the modern world, particularly when you get these demographic subsplits, right, is, you know, if you have like a pre-registered theory and then you dive into the administrative data and you can find that theory confirmed, I think that's like pretty powerful evidence. If you have this kind of thing where it's like, well, we found this randomization instrument and we know that there's rich administrative data in Sweden.
Yeah.
So let's like go spelunking.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, there's no statistically significant impact on kids. Bummer. Yeah. But then it's like, but what if we split the kids by gender? And it's like, then it's statistically significant on girls, but not for boys. Like, is it? Like, maybe, yeah. Right? Like, I again, particularly since this is such a large team of researchers, like, let's look at the Norwegian administrative data if we can.
Yeah.
If this exact same pattern pops up in even like just a very sociologically similar country,
yeah,
but like literally a different country, then it'd be like, okay, they're probably onto something. But I want to see a little bit more given the need to go into these demographic subsplits. There's no really compelling reason why joint versus solo custody would lead to better educational outcomes for girls and not for boys. Now, if you can find that empirically in like a really robust way, I will believe it and start searching for theoretical explanations. But you've given me one country. And
it's Sweden, though. And, it's your favorite, favorite country.
But I mean, it's just this is just one of these things where like, yeah, it's one country. It's not an incredibly compelling theoretical explanation.
No, it's not.
So it's kind of like fun fact about the data. But yeah, like,
who knows?
I want to see more data before I get too invested in this.
All right. Well, if one of these nine authors wants to reach out and explain to us a better theoretical story for what's going on with girls and boys here, or to tell us that we're being too harsh on their empirical stuff, please reach out. Otherwise, we'll see you guys next week. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bubba Wallace here from 2311 Racing. You know what's slower than a pace car? Waiting at the car wash. That's when I fire up Chumba Casino. It turns those slow minutes into fast fun. With new games every week, you'll never get bored. Next time you're stuck in the slow lane, speed up with Chumba. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.